welcome to the CJOB Sports Show podcast. Yes, it's me. I'm back. We're going to talk to journalist Mary Ormsby. She's got a new book about Ben Johnson, about his rise and his fall all these years later. And the newest member of the Winnipeg Sea Bears joins us as well. His name is Jared Ogunbemi Jackson. That's all coming up on the podcast. ...1988, Ben Johnson became a Canadian hero when he won gold in the 100 meters in Seoul, South Korea, and then was stripped of his gold due to a positive drug test. It was one of the biggest stories in Canadian sports history. And Mary Ormsby, formerly of the Toronto Star, where she spent 35 years reporting on events like the Olympics, has written a book called World's Fastest Man, and there's an asterisk beside the man part of that, and she joins us now on the show. Mary, take us back to 1988 and just the spectacle that was the Ben Johnson saga.
No, absolutely. In 1987, Ben became officially and authoritatively the world's fastest man when he won the world championship in Rome and beat his arch rival, Carl Lewis of the United States, in world record time. Fast forward to the next year, the rivalry between those two guys was huge. It really captured people around the planet. This was very big, and to have people care about track and field in this kind of way was quite unprecedented. You had this quiet, Canadian, understated guy in Ben Johnson and a flashy, talkative, flamboyant guy in Carl Lewis. So they go into Seoul, and, you know, there's all kinds of hype. It's huge. And in the stadium itself, 70,000 plus people. And it was a race for the ages. It was the first time four men had run under 10 seconds in a race. And Ben, of course, won that race, as you referenced, world record time. And he did it in a way he had time to even slow down at the end, point up his finger number one in the air and turn his head to taunt Carl Lewis. So it was like an incredible, iconic moment in Canadian history because he won it in that spectacular way, and he was a bit cheeky as he did it.
But what happened next? 24 hours, just this incredible, so far away from Canada too, right? A massive time difference. We don't have social media, right? The immediacy of news isn't the same as it was then, where newspapers ruled the land. What was it like in the subsequent day or two after he wins that gold medal?
That's right. He won it a 14-hour time difference between, Toronto and Seoul. And so it's a Saturday. He wins on a Saturday. By Monday, he knows he's in trouble. First part of his A sample of his urine sample has tested positive. So they have to test the B part of that sample on Monday afternoon. And by Monday night in Korea, they're trying to defend him and keep his gold medal in his hand, which didn't happen because he tested positive for an anabolic steroid. And that, of course, is a performance-enhancing drug. And the tiniest trace, doesn't have to be an amount, just a trace of it in your urine, you're done. That's it. Gone. He flew home very early Tuesday morning, and all hell broke loose. You know, it was the biggest story in the world because, the news in Canada broke around, 4 or 5 a.m. And we were running around like crazy people in Seoul trying to find him at 4 or 5 a.m., over there. And he was long gone. So it was just, he's responsible for the greatest high in Olympic history and the greatest low. And it certainly did shake up, our knowledge and the way we view doping in sport.
So your book chronicles all of this, the fallout, the aftermath. Was Canada mad at Ben Johnson, or were they mad at people that caught him?
At the time, Christian, I think, and I'm sorry to even say this, but it really exposed, an ugly underbelly of, Canadians. There was a lot of racist backlash. People were angry at him. How could you let us down? How could you do this to us after being, so euphoric for you, and then you did this. And there was the specter of ungrateful immigrant, all that. And you could see that in the archival material, how it was written, how he was treated, and how he was really hounded. He didn't have anybody. He was really isolated when he came back to Canada. He had to hide in his house, but he was jailed in there. So he took the brunt of everything. And as you said, there was no internet back then, but the world shaming, there were like waves and waves of it. It was a lot for one person to shoulder. And he took the brunt of all of it largely by himself.
Because when he won the gold medal, he was Canadian. But when he lost the gold medal because of the drug test, he became a Jamaican immigrant, right?
That's right. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. You know, it is quite shameful. Looking back on it and the way we described it, and it's really quite a horrible treatment.
So in writing this book, did you go back and see what you wrote then? And do you like what you saw?
Well, I saw what I wrote, and I saw what a lot of us wrote, you know, and overall it was very, you know, it was harsh on him. It was harsh on his coach, Charlie Francis, and harsh on his teammates. And part of that reason for the book is, you know, as a journalist, me, I can't speak for everybody, I think, well, did I do a good enough job back then asking enough questions at the time? Like, how was he actually treated in Seoul? Because that hearing I talked about earlier, you know, where he keeps his medal, a lot of things, it was a rush hearing. I thought there was he was not given due process. And that's when I began writing about it again, like in around 2016, 2017, 2018. And then it grew into a book where we worked together, Ben and I, to have a closer, more detailed look to see, you know, were you kind of ripped off when you should have had your rights protected at that critical juncture of defending yourself, after your urine test. So that's how the book came about.
And so that's an important note. You worked with Ben. You talked to Ben in putting this together.
Yeah. Yes, I did. And he was great. We spent, you know, probably about 25 or 30 hours of like formal taped interviews and all that. And he got files, he got photographs, he dug into what he had. And I will tell you, he really dug into some really deep, painful areas I didn't think he would go into. So it's quite a raw, you know, bunch of emotions that come out in the book as well as a lot of like investigative work and retracing and paperwork and interviews of people who were actually, you know, who were in the rooms with him at certain times. And he was very forthcoming. I think it's a very candid book and he didn't really hold back.
Because this summer, it'll be 36 years since this happened and is ultimately the event that it defines his athletic career. Does it define his whole life and what you surmise from talking to him?
Yes, it does in many ways. What happened in Seoul, you know, it was just absolutely crushing. And the IOC did a really great job of branding, you know, saying this is the worst doping villain of all time. And we're always going to trot out him as our trophy catch for all time. It's, you know, every story about doping and IOC and, you know, athletics, there's a Ben Johnson mention, but as we found out over time, and Canadians have become, I think, much more sympathetic to Ben's plight, that, you know, even in that particular race, six of the eight guys in that 100-meter final in Seoul went on to become linked directly or indirectly to doping violations, you know. So, you know, there's this idea that he was singled out in Seoul, and it was very unfair. And as you know, the people are still doping today. They're still getting caught and they're still using the same sort of excuses like I didn't do it. So not a lot has actually changed.
We've seen over the years, all kinds of drug positive tests. We've seen overturns like Simona Halep in the tennis world had her long ban erased and she is playing again now. It all depends on the process of appeal and she was allowed one. And part of this book is that Ben's process maybe wasn't the same, and would it have been different if he was white?
All that is in there, and Ben really does feel that if he had been a white guy, this would not have happened to him. And it's funny, I could mention very quickly that, you know, Canada and Canadian government officials and Canadian sport officials, I think, were quite deficient in their robust defense of Ben back then, the days and weeks after Seoul, and maybe the months after, too. But in 1998 in Nagano, Japan, the snowboarder, Rosser Bagliati, Canadian, wins gold, test positive for weed. But the COA, and they should, the COA went to bat for him and found out that weed was on skiing's performance-enhancing drug list, but not on the IOC's list. So, you know, by fighting for him, they got his medal back. So Canadian officials can work a little harder sometimes to help their athletes, as they should. I personally just don't think Ben got as much help as he deserved and should have had. If you can put aside the fact that he was cheating, that came later, but everyone deserves due process in the moment, innocent until proven otherwise.
So in writing this book, Mary, do you do you get the sense that Ben feels bitter about how it went down? How does he feel now over three decades later?
I would say he's bitter, resentful, felt he was unfairly singled out. And it broke him many times along the way. But I have to tell you, this guy is resilient. He is strong. You can see why he was world champion, and why he was able to compete at that level. He's really worked hard, hasn't always been successful, trying to, clear his name, restore his reputation if he can. So he's sort of hoping at some point that, he will be, if not totally exonerated, then some sort of review or reexamination of his treatment might shed a kinder light on him right now.
The story is one we all know well, or think we know well, but a lot more behind the scenes. The book is World's Fastest Man with an Asterisk Beside Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. It is on sale now. The author is Mary Ormsby. Mary, appreciate your time. Thanks for this conversation and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Winnipeg Sea Bears continuing to round out the roster for the upcoming CEBL season. The Sea Bears a couple days ago announced the signing of Garden City Collegiate product Jared Ogunbemi Jackson. After winning back-to-back provincial Quad A high school titles at Garden City, the now 32-year-old went to the University of Calgary, where he had a great career. He's their all-time leader in steals, third in scoring, rode that to nearly a decade of play across several European basketball leagues, and now he's coming home for the summer. Earlier today, I had the chance to chat with Jared and ask him why he wanted to play for the Sea Bears.
Multiple reasons. First off, just, being a professional athlete, being able to play in your hometown is something very unique, and it's not an opportunity that comes around all the time. So it's something I definitely didn't want to pass up. I've been overseas for 9 years, but, playing in front of my friends and family is a different type of opportunity. And also just seeing how successful the team was last year, and also playing for a coach like Mike Taylor, who I've been in contact with for the past year, and just seeing all this success, and I just want to be a part of it.
So being overseas then, at any point in the last 5 years, did you look at the CEBL and think, okay, I could come home, this league is looks like something that could be for real? When did it become a reality that this league entered your thought?
Yeah, like the past, 3-4 years, every single summer I've had multiple teams, multiple coaches get in contact with me throughout my seasons overseas and ask me if I want to play. And, the thoughts crossed my mind, but, with my seasons overseas in Europe, they intertwine and it's a long season. So, it just never really worked out perfectly. Whereas this time around, I'm home earlier than I normally would be. So my body's much fresher. My mind is fresh. And I have time to prepare for the season the right way, physically and mentally. And it just made a lot of sense. And I think doing it in my hometown, it's only right.
What did you hear about what it was like at Sea Bears games last year, and how much did that impact your decision?
I went to about 3 Sea Bears games last year, and the atmosphere was just amazing. It was incredible. It didn't feel real to me that, I'm watching a professional basketball game here in my hometown where I was born and raised. And after the game, I'm going home to my friends and family. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't feel real. So the team was good. They were very successful as well. I was able to see and meet some of the coaching staff, a lot of the players. So I'm familiar with, a few of the guys already. And, it was just a special opportunity. And, I'm hoping that this year we can even take it to another level.
So have you any experience playing with or against any of the players that are on the Sea Bears?
On the Sea Bears, I've played with Chad previously. Like, when back in high school, we used to play against each other. When we were younger, like teenagers and youths, we used to play in community leagues against each other. Shane Osiyande, I played against him when I was at University of Calgary. Let me think. Alex Campbell, I played against him when I was in Holland, I believe. He was there at the same time, so I played against him. He's a really good player, great defender. we're a great guard. We can make a lot of reads and a lot of plays on the ball. So I'm looking forward to playing with him as well. So I've played with a few of the guys and a lot of guys throughout the entire league. So I'm familiar with quite a number of people in this league.
What was it about Mike Taylor and his pitch that further drew you in to want to become a Sea Bear?
I mean, from the first day, as soon as he got the job, I was one of the first calls, and he just said, you're a hometown guy. You're going to be a priority for us. He mentioned how many people had contacted him as soon as he got the job and told them to give me a call. And he just made that a priority, and he just never let up. He would contact me on a weekly basis, check in on me, see how my season was doing, seeing what the opportunities for me to play looked like. And he was very honest and forthcoming with me and just letting me have a process for myself, because the European seasons are so long, and he's has a lot of experience coaching overseas and knows how taxing that can be on the body. So he just said, whatever I need, whenever I want to come in, if it's to practice, to watch video, to get treatment, if I'm going to play or not, like, he supported me 100%. And he definitely wanted the best for me and the best for my family. And I'm going back to last summer, so the fact that the timing worked out where I could be here much earlier, it just made too much sense not to suit up and play for my hometown.
So let's go back in time a bit. You were a standout high school player at Garden City. You had a great career at Calgary, University of Calgary, with the Dinos. Why did you want to go to Europe?
It's been my goal since I was like 12 or 13 years old. Early on, obviously, I wanted to play in the NBA. I think every little kid does. And, as I got older, it's just watching European leagues and seeing how competitive it is. There's a lot of ex-NBA guys who play in Europe. People will make very good money in Europe as well. It's a great profession. You can really, if you put yourself in the right position, you can help take care of your family. So it's something that literally when I was maybe 13, 14 years old was already a goal of mine. And I'm just somebody who is just so addicted to basketball. I love basketball. I watch basketball all day. I watch videos, highlights of everything, of every level. And I would always just have daydreams of myself being somewhere in Europe, playing in front of thousands of fans, potentially meeting my wife out there and having a family. And I did that this past few years as well. So I was able to make that dream a reality. And, I just want to keep it going as long as I can.
So you've played in a lot of Europe, France, Denmark, Netherlands, Finland, Spain, Portugal, Russia is technically Europe, also a bit Asian, but technically Europe. So did the dream live up to the reality in playing in Europe?
Oh yeah, it definitely has. I feel like any profession, you got to build your way up. So, I started out in Portugal and I had to learn my way, learn the ropes of how to be a successful player out there, how to be a professional. It's different when you're thousands and thousands of miles away from your family. And, sometimes you're on teams where some of your teammates don't speak English, or some of your coaches don't speak great English, or your staff. So, sometimes you can feel alone, but, I've been able to weather the storm and get better each year and make a name for myself overseas. And, I'm really looking forward to what comes next.
What did you learn about yourself as a basketball player playing in so many different environments?
I would say the biggest thing is I think I'm somebody who can adapt quickly. Like you mentioned, playing for 9 years and in what, 7 or 8 different countries. Every country has a different play style, different rules, different athletes, different ways to, different tactics. Especially when I was in Spain, it was a very tactical game. When I was in Spain, in France, it was a very athletic game. Here in Russia, where I was this past year, like, it was just a combination of the two, just physicality and tactics and individual talent. Like, it was a phenomenal league. So just being able to adapt and play my game and let it be successful at any level. So, like, I'm at the point in my career now where I know and I am positive that I can go to any league and my game will translate and I can have an impact not only on the game but on my team as well.
Bouncing around all these different countries, is that because you wanted to try different countries, or was it a matter of, okay, I need to find a job, who wants me?
For the most part, when you sign contracts overseas, it's not like typical contracts you see in North America for 3, 4, 5 years at a time. most of the contracts that players sign overseas are one-year deals. So you're going to sign a one-year deal, and then you have the flexibility to move, you know, and teams do a lot of changes every year. You know, last year where I was in France, this year they have, I believe, two players from last year's roster and 10 new guys. And that's completely normal in most teams overseas. And that's just how you climb the ladder. You know, like I said, when I started in Portugal, you know, it was a good starter league for me, and I've worked my way up. And this past year playing in the VTB, you know, it's like a top five international league in the world, you know, outside of the NBA. So the reason I've moved around a lot is because I'm trying to, you know, continue to climb the ladder and get to the best leagues and the best competition there is.
Now you're coming home to Canada. Where do you feel the CEBL fits in that puzzle of top leagues?
I think right now, as far as the summer league goes, it's definitely becoming one of the better ones out there. You know, I've been following it since the beginning. I have a lot of friends who played, you know, in the CEBL from the beginning, like Jordan Baker. I used to, when we were in Portugal, he was my roommate, actually, my first professional season. So, and we go way back to university and FIBA 3-on-3. So like guys like that and Chad and other people around the league. But I think if you look at the individual talent that's coming in every single year, now you're starting to get a lot of guys who play overseas and a lot of guys who have played in high leagues and G leagues and things like that. So it's going in the right direction, and it's becoming a very competitive league. So I'm excited to finally be a part of it.
So you're going to be 33 by the end of the season. What are your goals now? As I'm trying not to call you old because you're less than a year older than I am, but yeah. what goals do you have now in your basketball career as you enter your mid-30s?
Honestly, I feel like I'm in my prime. I feel like I'm coming off one of the best seasons of my career. My body feels great. And, you know, the overseas prime definitely is the 28, 29 to 32, 33, 34 range. So I feel great. And I still have a lot of great years and a lot more to accomplish. You know, I've set out many goals and I've been able to accomplish a lot of them. And I want to keep it pushing. Obviously want to focus on the season with the CBL, but you know, I have high aspirations for my next professional season afterwards as well. So for me, the sky's the limit. I truly believe that. My age, I feel good. To me, it's just a number, but I feel great.
Have you played in a league with the target score finish before?
I never have. And I think that's going to be very interesting. I understand the point of it, especially from a fan perspective. You know, you're always going to have a moment or a memorable moment for whoever wins that game, and it kind of gives the team that's coming from behind a chance to get back in the game as well. So it's something new, something unique, and I'll have to get used to that as well because it's something I've never played in before.
It's a lot of fun just from a broadcasting point of view because every game ends in a walk-off, right? Every game ends with a game winner, and from that point of view, I think it's really cool. It also gives teams a chance when you're down, you know, 15 points near the end of a game. Instead of the other team just kind of dribbling out the clock and you got to play the foul game, you have a chance, right? You get stops, you score, and boom, you got a game again.
Yeah, exactly. So it's definitely a unique thing that they're bringing to the game. And even if you're, like you said, if you're a team that's up 10 or 15, as soon as that target score hits, it's a different kind of game. Now you have to value each possession even more, you know, because if you have 4 to 5 bad possessions, the other team could go on a run. And the next thing you know, you're in a point to maybe lose the game. So it presents a unique mindset and approach to the game, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it goes, and hopefully I'll be able to impact some games and help us win down the stretch.
For those who haven't seen you play before, how would you describe yourself as a basketball player?
The biggest thing I would say about myself, I think I'm a high level competitor. I want to win. I wear my heart on my sleeve. Every time I step on the floor, I'm going to give 110%. I'm somebody who can, you know, score the ball very well. I can get my teammates involved. I can control the pace of the game, make plays, big plays that help our team win. I can, you know, shoot the ball very well. So I think I do a little bit of everything. And I'm I'm really excited for, you know, the people who grew up watching me when I was 5 years old, 6 years old, 10 years old, all the way to high school, to university, to all my friends and family. I've had like at least 50 to 60 messages as soon as I signed, from people asking about season tickets and home opener. So I'm excited for them to finally get to see me play as a professional and not just through their phone or through you know, a link on their laptop that doesn't work too well. So I'm excited to play in front of my friends and family, this city, and I'm excited to represent my hometown.
Now, you've been to games. You know what the crowd is like. Have you played in environments like that that would match the energy, or have those been fewer and far between across your stops across Europe?
Yeah, I have. Last season, even in France where we were, we had a brand new arena. So I was in Orleans, and they just built a brand new arena. Last year was the first year they played in it, and now they have a lot of international competitions playing there. That building, I believe, fit like 12,000. And I can't remember, between 11 and 12,000, something like that. But we had a lot of games that were sold out last year. And, you know, I've been around. I've played in, you know, big arenas in Italy, big arenas in Turkey, France, like a lot of places. And the atmosphere has been crazy because European countries, they love their sports and they love basketball. A lot of places I've been. So I played in some hostile environments, and but definitely the CBL and the Sea Bears have an amazing fan base, and I'm looking forward to playing in front of them as well.
Well, Jared, we're looking forward to seeing you on the court very soon. Thanks for this, and best of luck as you get ready for the season.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Jared Ogunbemi-Jackson, the newest member of the Winnipeg Sea Bears.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.